This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine the unlawful U.S. overthrowing of Venezuela and its presidency.
The attempted coup is going on, even as we're listening to this show. We're living through historic times.
We learn about the organization Reprieve's important work challenging the death penalty, torture, and targeted drone attacks.
Reprieve is a marvelous organization. We're privileged to have one of its leaders speak with us today.
Our own Michael Smith reads a recent piece he wrote on the history of COINTELPRO. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The Trump administration is attempting to illegally overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuela and its president, Nicolas Maduro. The effort is being led by Trump's recently appointed envoy, Elliot Abrams, the notorious convicted perjurer who was complicit during the Reagan administration in the massacre and cover-up of a mass slaughter of indigenous people in Central America. John Bolton, Trump's national security advisor, is working alongside Abrams. He recently showed the American government's intent by flashing a handwritten sign on a yellow pad stating, 5,000 troops to Venezuela. Showing his contempt for international law, he famously said that if the top part of the United Nations building was lopped off, it would not make any difference. So far, the United States has been unable to topple the Venezuelan government. It's been unable to win over the Venezuelan military. The USA is now embargoing Venezuela, which is a form of a medieval siege aimed at depriving Venezuelans of food and medicine. The U.S. government and its ally Great Britain have frozen Venezuelans' assets held abroad and prevented trade with that country, whose economy has shrunk dramatically. The USA has secured support for its coup attempt from the right-wing governments in Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, as well as the countries of the European Union. We speak today with Ajamu Baraka, who's recently returned from Venezuela. He's on the steering committee of the U.S. Peace Council, which organized the trip. Baraka is the national organizer of Black Alliance for Peace. He writes for the Black Agenda Report and was the 2016 Green Party candidate for vice president. Ajamu Baraka, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Ajamu, we're really living through a historic moment right now. The late William Blum wrote a book called Killing Hope, where he documented the CIA's overthrowing of the Mossadegh government in Iran because Mossadegh wanted to nationalize Iran's oil. In 1953, the next year in Guatemala, the United States overthrew the government of Jacobo Arbenz because he nationalized fallow land that belonged to the United Fruit Company, an American company. And then in 1973, of course, there's the infamous coup against the socialist president Salvador Allende in Chile. The United States overthrew him and put Augusto Pinochet, the military dictator, in his place. And now we're watching this process go on in Venezuela. What does the United States government want to do in Venezuela? I mean, after all, Nicolas Maduro was elected a year ago in a free and fair election.
Exactly. I mean, what your question basically begins to point toward the answer. And that is that the U.S. is still committed to maintaining regional hegemony and targeting any movement, any states that threaten that hegemony. This is in line with their stated objectives reflected in the national security strategy that says that any challenge to U.S. hegemony on a regional level, that state, that threat would be targeted and removed, in essence. And that is exactly what we are seeing here with the situation with Venezuela. That is more than just their attempt to want to control the oil of Venezuela. That's important for them, of course, or the resources. Venezuela represents the leading edge of a progressive development in the region. That the U.S. recognized was a threat to its hegemony and a threat to the hegemony of the Western capitalist order. So while they were bogged down for many years in the so-called Middle East, they made the shift toward re-intensifying their efforts to destabilize Venezuela, beginning really around 2013, 2014, and with the designation by the Obama administration that Venezuela represented a threat to U.S. national interests. So the U.S. has been quite consistent in its efforts to try to make sure that it remains a hegemonic power in the Americas.
Just what exactly is the United States doing in order to facilitate and accomplish their coup against the elected president of Venezuela?
Well, they have embarked on a multi-pronged strategy to isolate the nation, to undermine its economy, to try to generate popular opposition internally to the elected government, and then finally to move toward a more open coup with the plan to have Juan Guaido to pretend to be the president, and then to generate international support primarily from European nations and their vassal states to recognize Juan Guaido as the interim president. So this strategy has been one in which the objective is so-called regime change, and it is a strategy that is quite open and obvious, but is also a strategy that has actions that are clearly illegal, that go beyond the constraints of the United Nations Charter, is in clear violation of international law, and it is a strategy that, through sanctions, have been identified as actually representing crimes against humanity. So this is the strategy. This is what they are attempting to do, again, because they see Venezuela is not only a threat to their regional hegemony, but a model that needs to be crushed for any opportunities or anything that seems to be something that other states in the global south might try to replicate.
Ajamu, when the U.S. was preparing to invade Iraq, it spread a false narrative about Iraq having weapons of mass destruction. We've recently seen the propaganda apparatus fabricate a story about Venezuelans setting fire to trucks at the border, bringing food. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's part of the propaganda front, propaganda objective, which is to basically paint the Venezuelan government as a government that is not concerned by its own about its own citizens, and willing and able to do whatever it needs to do in order to maintain its dominance in the country. But even the New York Times, that helped to facilitate that narrative of Venezuela and Venezuelan government involved in all kinds of repressive activities, they had to retract the story about the trucks being burnt on the border. And even before they had to retract that story, there was already evidence circulating in the alternative press that demonstrated or revealed that it was the hooligans on the Colombian side that were responsible for burning the trucks at the border. But that incident was part of the construction of this narrative of the government not being concerned about its own citizens. But the pushback has been that if the U.S. was really concerned about the humanitarian interests in Venezuela, the humanity of the people of Venezuela, then it should remove the sanctions that have been identified as crimes against humanity. It should release Venezuelan resources that will allow them to purchase the medicines and the food that the people need. But again, the narrative is to construct a Venezuelan that does not exist in reality.
Does Maduro have much popular support?
I think that it's quite obvious when one sees the the images, of course, in the alternative press, of the popular mobilizations of Venezuelan people that have demonstrated that there is a popular support for their government and their process in Venezuela. I think it's important to point out this. One of the things that we learned while we were in Venezuela, that is the peace delegation, is that as a consequence of that cyber attack, even some elements that weren't happy with the Maduro government felt a nationalistic response to that attack, that they responded with real revulsion against the idea that the Juan Guaido would invite that kind of attack on the Venezuelan people. So there is popular support. It was demonstrated in the streets and demonstrated in the election, where you had something like 6.8 million people who voted for Maduro. And he had a percentage of the eligible vote in Venezuela that was higher than the percentage of the eligible vote that Donald Trump received in 2016. So there is a popular base there. But of course, according to the Western media, the masses of Venezuelans are opposed to their own government. But the images and what we have found on the ground there in Venezuela reveal that to be a pure fabrication.
John, well, you just returned from Venezuela. What did you observe about who is supporting the opposition to Maduro? Talk about this with respect to the racial aspect and the class aspect of this opposition.
Mm-hmm. You know, Michael, that's a very interesting question, one in which we've been raising with people in the U.S. who have been confused about the terms of struggle and what social forces are in motion. It's quite clear to us that the opposition is representative of the traditional oligarchy in that country. The Creole class that emerged coming out of the revolt against the Spanish in the 19th century. Creole class is primarily one would perceive to be white in the U.S. and white, of course, in Venezuela. So this is a very interesting dichotomy between the opposition and the masses of people who are the Maduro supporters or the supporters of their process. I don't like reducing these processes to these individuals because what we have in place in Venezuela is, in fact, a revolutionary process, a Bolivarian process in which the people are quite clear transcends individuals. So the base of the Bolivarian process in Venezuela is in the working class. It is in the black and brown mestizo working class, if you will, and in the rural parts of the country. And so the visual dichotomy between the opposition and the masses of the people who support the process is quite stark. We had a chance to visit a few of the communities that were the basis of support for their process. For example, a community called Katia, in which is 1.5 million people in western Caracas, and the leadership of that community are primarily not only black and brown, but women. And they're the ones that pour into the city in these massive demonstrations of support for their process. So, you know, we have to try to explain to people back in the U.S., that not only are you colluding with the Trump administration and the bourgeois Democrats in this intervention into Venezuela, but you are, in fact, colluding and collaborating with a white supremacist, imperialist element in Venezuela when you are silent or you give your support to U.S. policies in Venezuela.
Ajamo, who was actually on the delegation?
It was a collection of some of the leaders of the U.S. peace community and anti-imperialist communities. It was organized by the U.S. Peace Council, in which I am a part of the membership. It was hosted on the ground by COSI, which is an organization that is part of the World Peace Council. On the delegation, we had the coordinator of the United National Anti-War Coalition. We had the coordinator and director of the International Action Center. We had the president of the Veterans for Peace. We had the two co-coordinators of Popular Resistance. We had the president of WILF, the U.S. Section. This was a reflection of a number of peace and anti-war organizations that were part of this delegation.
2 weeks ago, there were demonstrations in 150 cities around the world in support of Venezuela's right to self-determination. And there were demonstrations in 70 U.S. Cities as well. Are there other actions being planned now, and by whom?
Yes, it is. And as your listeners know, there was a massive demonstration last weekend in Washington. We're going to be returning to Washington on March 30th. It's another massive demonstration being organized by the same organizations that were part of the delegation going to Venezuela, primarily anchored by the United National Anti-War Coalition and other organizations. The target of the March 30th mobilization, of course, will be Venezuela, but it is making a pivot also toward putting attention on NATO. NATO has decided that they're going to celebrate their 70th anniversary of their founding on April the 4th in Washington. And April the 4th, as your listeners probably remember and know, is the same date that Dr. King was murdered in Memphis. So here, Dr. King, the apostle of peace, these gangsters, these criminals, have decided that they're going to celebrate in Washington, D.C., the establishment of this aggressive militarized structure on that day. So in opposition to that, we are organizing that weekend on March 30th, this mobilization, and we are putting the target on NATO and making the link between NATO and Venezuela. We all know that, for example, Colombia is a global partner of NATO, and we just saw yesterday that in the meetings with the neo-fascists from Brazil, Bolsonaro, that the Trump administration has suggested that there may be a role for Venezuela in NATO. So we want people to understand the role of NATO, its character, its class interests, and so we're making that connection on March the 30th. There'll be a week of activities from March 30th to April the 4th, peace conference, a festival organized by the World Without War, a coalition. The World Peace Council will be having an event on Sunday afternoon, in Washington, D.C. after March 31st. So there's a series of activities culminating in an activity in April the 4th that evening that's organized by the Black Alliance for Peace. There we're going to be launching our campaign against domestic repression also.
If our listeners want to learn more about this, how do they get in touch?
For the full schedule of activities, they should go to the popularresistance.org website. They can also go to the blackalliancefor peace.com website or the United National Anti-War Coalition to get more information on the series of activities being organized between March 30th and April the 4th.
Ajamu Baraka, we're very pleased to be able to speak with you about this. You've just come back from Venezuela. Before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about Colombia joining NATO. After all, NATO was an anti-communist coalition of the United States and European armies that was formed during the Cold War. And now we see the United States recruiting Colombia and making an inroad here in South America. That's quite a qualitative change, I think. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, this is part of what we were referring to a little bit earlier, that NATO has gone beyond just a focus on the North Atlantic area. We have seen over the last few decades that NATO has been the primary instrument that's been used by the U.S. and Western European powers to project power globally. It was the instrument used in Libya. It's been an instrument that's now being used against Venezuela. Colombia is what they're calling a global partner, and Trump has just offered the possibility of Venezuela being a part of their global partnership. So they're not quite members, but they are so-called global partners. So it reveals, once again, Michael, the true character of that structure. That structure is an aggressive imperialist structure that's being used to perpetuate and maintain the dominance of the colonial capitalist project, Western European project. So, you know, it's been revealing and I think a gift for us to help people to understand the true nature and the interest behind NATO.
Ajamo, it's always an inspiration to have you on Law and Disorder, and we look forward to seeing you in D.C. and in some of these many actions.
It's been a pleasure, as always, to be with you. I'm really honored that you allow my voice on this very important show. Thank you so much.
We're honored to be able to have you, Ajamo. Keep up the good work and take it easy.
Be safe. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Was abolished in the United Kingdom. In 1999, human rights attorney Clive Stafford Smith founded the nonprofit organization Reprieve. Smith had represented over 300 prisoners facing the death penalty in the southern United States and has helped secure the release of 65 Guantanamo Bay prisoners and others internationally who claim that the U.S. government has tortured them. Reprieve currently works to represent 15 prisoners remaining in Guantanamo Bay, as well as an evolving caseload of death row clients around the world. It investigates international complicity in extraordinary renditions and has recently started working in Pakistan with the Foundation for Fundamental Rights to begin discussions on the use of drones there. Joining us to discuss Reprieve's human rights work and their support for former Guantanamo detainees is Katie Taylor, a deputy director at Reprieve who coordinates their Life After Guantanamo project. Katie has worked at War Child UK and in Palestine on human and children's rights issues for several local and international agencies. Katie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Reprieve takes on some of the most difficult legal cases in existence. Did the organization begin purely as death penalty related and then come to include things like renditions and now drones?
Yeah, it did actually, but it's because there is quite a logical connection. So as you might recall, when Guantanamo first opened, all of the men there were facing the death penalty. So, you know, one of the only bits of information that came out was that, in a sense, everyone was on death row. Everybody was facing the death penalty there. So it grew naturally out of Reprieve's death penalty work.
I understand you have organizations in Australia, the Netherlands, and also the United States. Why those countries in particular?
Well, those are sister organizations, and, you know, it has to do with partners that we've worked with over the years, and, of course, looking at the U.S., you know, a lot of our work initially and today, indeed, is focused very much at holding the U.S. government to account, you know, particularly in terms of its policies and practices related to the war on terror.
You know, you work globally against capital punishment and help people who are facing the death penalty, but your special focus is in the United States, in the southern part of the United States. Why is it that you focus on the southern part of the United States?
Well, our focus really is where the death penalty is occurring, and, you know, in many ways it's occurring there, but we certainly work all over, as you said, all over where people are facing that. It is something that we address, yeah.
So you coordinate Life After Guantanamo Project. Mm. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is a project that started in 2009, and I've been on it since 2010. And it started in reaction to Obama's pledge, on his second day in office, the first executive order he signed, which said that Guantanamo was going to be closed within a year. And the lawyers at Reprieve, who had been representing, you know, so many of the men at Guantanamo, they thought, oh gosh, you know, we really are going to need support in helping the men when they are released. And, you know, I think it was something that a lot of the habeas counsels working with Guantanamo detainees realized, is that really release isn't the end of the story, that there are so many challenges that former Guantanamo detainees face when they're released, particularly the fact that so many of them couldn't return to their home countries because they would face torture or other types of persecution there. So they were resettled in a range of third countries, host countries throughout the world. And these were often places where they'd never stepped foot before, where they didn't speak the language, where they had no friends or personal connections, didn't know how the system worked. And the types of services that they were provided with in those countries were really inconsistent. And so there were some countries that had a sort of ready-made refugee package for them, and some countries that were making it up as they went along. And so we recognized at Reprieve that these men were going to need a lot of support. So we were able to get some funding from the United Nations, a special fund that they had for victims of torture, and, you know, devised a way of trying to work in all of these different countries to ensure that the men had access to the services that they needed to get back on their feet.
Katie, talk a bit, if you will, about the way these men were tortured. I assume all of them had some exposure to that at Guantanamo.
They certainly all did at Guantanamo, and most of them before Guantanamo as well, because, you know, nearly everyone was held in some sort of secret prison before being rendered to Guantanamo, you know, often Kandahar or Bagram in Afghanistan, but other places as well. You know, the range of torture is immense, and obviously there's been a lot of focus on that in the Senate Intelligence Torture Report, which unfortunately has never been declassified, so we're only able to see a redacted version of the introduction to it, which obviously is a huge shame because it means that no one is being held accountable. But in terms of the types of torture, you know, I think what is unique about Guantanamo, and indeed the CIA black sites as well, is that it was really designed by psychologists. And there was a real element of, you know, breaking down the personality and purposely making people helpless as part of that, that obviously has huge repercussions as well once people are released from Guantanamo. But another thing that I, you know, in terms of torture that I feel hasn't received enough attention is, you know, the fact of indefinite detention itself is actually a type of torture, and this is according to the former special representative to the UN on torture, who was looking particularly at Guantanamo and thought just the fact of keeping people in a state where they haven't been charged or tried, but there's no end in sight, and detention, you know, without end, is itself a form of torture. And obviously that very much affects the men, the 40 men who are still there, 31 of whom haven't been charged at all.
Katie, I read that there were a few children at Guantanamo. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. One of our clients, Mohammed El-Gharani, was just 14 when he was rendered to Guantanamo. And, you know, it's an immense thing to have detained children in Guantanamo. And his story is really incredible. He was picked up at a mosque in Pakistan, again, at the age of 14, sent to Guantanamo. And one of the accusations, of course, he was, you know, didn't reach the level of charges, but one of the accusations that the U.S. government made against him was that he had been the mastermind of an Al-Qaeda cell in London. It would have occurred at a time when he was like maybe 6 or 8. At that point in his life, he was, you know, a Chadian immigrant in Saudi Arabia selling water and prayer beads on the street. You know, it's an absolutely incredible story, and just shows how wrong the U.S. got it in terms of their so-called evidence and the so-called, you know, facts that they had against people.
Katie, given the psychological abuse, and as you mentioned, the fact that psychologists actually consulted in assisting in the program of torture, what kind of social services are provided, if any, in the sort of re-entry process?
Yeah, it's different in each country. So each country has more or less designed its own program, and some countries do it really well, and some countries don't. What we advocate for and what we try to facilitate is extremely multidimensional, because there are so many things that you have to provide for in order for the men to really be able to engage in their rehabilitation. So psychological support, but also as a result of the torture, they often have some pretty serious medical conditions as well. You know, there are the types of conditions that come out of having been tortured that are chronic and require specialized medical assistance. You know, and that's at one end, but then there are very sort of basic day-to-day services that are required. So as I mentioned earlier, it's generally the case that men are sent to countries where they don't speak the language. You know, so in order to integrate into a new society, of course, you need to learn the language. And you need to have support to navigate whatever systems exist, you know, in terms of accessing social services and the support you need. And again, you know, it's definitely necessary to provide some of the basic needs as well that someone who has been incarcerated in Guantanamo for a decade or more would require, such as, you know, housing and financial support and things like that as well. So we really advocate for a multidisciplinary approach to rehabilitation. But again, that's not always the approach taken by the countries where men are resettled.
We're speaking with Katie Taylor of the organization Reprieve from our studio in New York with her in London. Katie, what kind of work are you doing now with respect to drones in Pakistan? Please talk about that and targeted killings and collateral damage.
Yes, well, we're looking a lot actually at Yemen right now, where there has been a huge uptick under the Trump administration in the use of drones. As well as ground raids. And so what we do is we support investigators on the ground and just try to collect the information from the communities that are affected and make sure that accurate information gets out, because it's very easy for the U.S. government to, you know, say that they've struck a village and 100% of the casualties were militants. And it's really important that investigators actually go and verify and figure out, you know, what actually happens and make sure that the voices of the victims get out. And what we found is that often the U.S. has no idea who it's targeted or who's been killed. And, you know, we really encourage that type of fact gathering. And, you know, we were quite disheartened by Trump's executive order, which came out, I think, about 2 weeks ago, saying that they are no longer consider themselves bound to even report on the casualties from their strikes.
Katie, what are the goals, in addition to exposing what's happening? Would Reprieve, for example, initiate litigation depending on your findings related to drones?
Yes, I mean, we have active litigation going now. So one case that we have going in the U.S. Is of a U.S. journalist who is based in Syria and has been targeted, it seems, several times by drones. And again, you know, he's challenging the government to say, look, am I on the kill list? Are you trying to actively kill me? And if so, how can this be challenged?
And how would he know that he was being targeted?
Well, I mean, I think if there are several drone strikes within near proximity, you get a bit suspicious.
So you're actually in court representing him?
Yes, we are, yeah.
Tell us about the litigation.
So it's now at a stage where the government has made the argument that it shouldn't be heard in open court, which, you know, again, is one of the limitations of working in counterterrorism. Is it's quite easy for governments to pull the trigger of, like, oh, you know, state secrets we couldn't possibly say. So we're trying to challenge that, because obviously we think that transparency is incredibly important.
Katie, on a personal note, can you tell us how you got involved in international human rights work?
I mean, it's always just been something that I felt extremely strongly about. You know, I'm not sure there's anything beyond that. I feel incredibly lucky to get to do the work that I do on issues that I think are some of the most important issues that we face as a society.
We saw that you worked previously at an entity called War Child UK. What do they do?
So that was an organization that looks at children's rights in conflict, in war zones. So I was particularly looking at protection programs in Afghanistan and Iraq for war-affected children.
Katie, just to go back a bit to the Guantanamo reentry issue and your work on that, do children or families of the released prisoners from Guantanamo often join the person who was released?
We encourage that as much as it's possible. I think one of our findings, having done this work for 10 years now, we've been running this project, and one of our major findings is that family support is so key to men's ability to rebuild their lives. So one of the things that we would advocate to a host government is that if the former detainee has family, has, you know, a wife or children, that they be able to rejoin them, and that family reunification is supported, so that, you know, it's what we would all want, you know, to be able to move on with our lives with our loved ones. As we've mentioned, there were many people who were children or indeed quite young when they went to Guantanamo, so they weren't previously married. And it's been wonderful. It's been one of the real perks of this work, watching them rebuild their lives and, you know, get married and have children and begin their lives as fathers. And, you know, it's been a really encouraging thing to see. And again, I think family life is sort of central to rehabilitation.
Obama, after he was elected, said that he was ending torture. But the great tragedy was that he also said we have to look forward, not backward, and no one was held to account for what the United States did. What was your reaction to that statement? And do you feel like we do that because no one was held to account and their justice was not done, that we're worried that it's going to continue or may continue in the future? After all, Trump said he's in favor of it.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, that's absolutely what keeps me up at night. You know, I think it was a huge mistake to basically create a system in which nobody's going to be held for account. I mean, of course, I hope that someday it is possible. But as long as people who were intimately engaged in some of these torture processes continue to have high-ranking positions, you know, there's nothing to stop this from happening again, and indeed it is happening again. You know, I think that having a president who's basically openly pro-torture is incredibly scary.
Yeah, well, he said torture works, and then he said he liked the idea of waterboarding, and he said he would do worse. Are they actually torturing people now? Do you know of any instances of this?
Well, I mean, in terms of, to answer the first part of your question, you know, I think the Senate Intelligence Report on CIA torture was quite clear in its conclusions that not only, you know, not only was it terrible, but it really didn't work. And I think, you know, again, torture throws up nothing but faulty evidence. The story that I told earlier about the child Mohammed al-Gharani when he was in Guantanamo, you know, torture evidence, you know, is what leads to false confessions and, you know, the perpetuation of an idea that an 8-year-old boy could have possibly, you know, been a mastermind of Al-Qaeda in a country he'd never, in fact, a continent he'd never visited. You know, so absolutely torture doesn't work. And again, I feel like that's been proven again and again in so many ways. Yeah, I'm not sure that Trump understands what waterboarding is if he thinks that that he would do worse, you know, or, you know, obviously he's coming at it from a different angle than we are. You know, I very much hope that the U.S. isn't engaged currently in torture, but I think that, you know, whether it's directly or indirectly supporting regimes and being that do torture and also being openly, having an administration that openly supports the idea of torture brings us very close to where we were in the past.
Did you say there were 45 prisoners remaining at Guantanamo?
40. There are 40.
And just a brief overview, if you can, what is it looking like for their release?
To be frank, I have not a huge amount of hope under the Trump administration, and there are a couple of reasons for this. So of the 40 men who are in Guantanamo, 31 of them have never been charged with a crime. So they're the so-called forever prisoners. And as far as we can tell, the administration has no intention of ever charging them with a crime. 5 of these men have been cleared for release, so that means that 6 agencies of the U.S., including the Department of Defense, Homeland Security, et cetera, have unanimously agreed that they should be released and that they are safe to release, and yet they're still sitting in Guantanamo. Meanwhile, under Trump, the process by which men can become cleared for release has been completely skewed, and now it's just a joke. And so basically this is called the Periodic Review Board process, whereby it's a board, again, made up of several agencies, and they are tasked with assessing whether someone is possibly going to be a risk in the future. But the way that they do so is... seems quite arbitrary, extremely arbitrary, to the extent that we've actually, if you go to the Reprieve website, we have set up a sort of spoof PRB process that you can go through yourself, where you can see whether or not you would pass your PRB. But what it means is that basically the only mechanism, which was an administrative mechanism, for men to be deemed safe to be released by the U.S. government is completely flawed, and under Trump, just stacked against the men, because it ultimately ends up as a political decision. And this is from an administration that has said that they clearly do not intend to release anyone from Guantanamo. And the result of that is just further years of indefinite detention. And again, the idea that the U.S. is holding 31 people that it's never charged with a crime and has no intention of releasing, I just think goes against everything that is American.
Katie, I'm glad you mentioned the website. We're going to have to go, but what is Reprieve's website for listeners?
So it's www.reprieve.org.uk.
Wonderful. Thank you and your colleagues for the amazing work that you're doing, and we hope to stay in touch with you and have you back in a few months.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on. I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
Take it easy, okay. Katie. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Oh, no problem.
Michael, you've written and published an article titled Lessons from the FBI's Secret War on Activism. It appeared in The Independent and on Portside, and we'd like to hear you read it today.
Well, happy to oblige you. The Federal Bureau of Investigation tried to destroy left organizations and the Black Freedom Movement during the last major upsurge in radical politics in this country in the 1960s. It looks like they're trying to do it again. The Bureau's COINTEL, counterintelligence program, was a secret operation the Bureau carried out against left-wing groups from 1956 to 1971. It first targeted the Communist Party and was expanded to the Socialist Workers Party, the SWP, in 1961, and then to the New Left in 1968. In a secret 1968 memo, longtime FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover directed his agents to, quote, expose, disrupt, and otherwise neutralize the activities of various New Left organizations. We must frustrate every effort of these groups and individuals to consolidate their forces or to recruit new or faithful adherents. Hoover directed his venom especially at the black movement, writing that, quote, we must prevent the rise of a new black messiah. The FBI and its accomplices in the Chicago Police Department admitted to the 1969 assassination of Chicago socialist and Black Panther leader Fred Hampton in his bed, along with his bodyguard Mark Clark. The circumstances around the murders of Martin Luther King Jr., who was harassed by the FBI for years, and Malcolm X remained suspicious. Although COINTELPRO was ended after it was exposed in 1971, particularly by the break-in at the Media Pennsylvania FBI office, and the FBI investigation of the SWP ended in 1976, their practices of government surveillance, infiltration, and disruption of radical groups have never gone away. Most of what we know about COINTELPRO resulted from a lawsuit, Socialist Workers Party versus Attorney General, which the SWP filed in 1973 through its attorney Leonard Boudin, the finest movement constitutional litigator of his time. In 1986, a federal judge in Manhattan awarded the party $264,000 in damages. The case is extraordinarily important today, when socialist ideas are growing in popularity and socialists are getting elected to office for the first time in almost 100 years. The FBI first investigated the SWP in 1940. When the Bureau added it to its COINTEL project in 1961, a secret memorandum said that the party had been, quote, openly espousing its line on local and national basis through running candidates for public office, and strongly directing and or supporting causes such as Castro's Cuba and integration problems in the South. The discovery aspect of the SWP lawsuit took 8 years and yielded an astounding 10 million pages of documents. The judge told Boudin, quote, you're not going to believe what's in these documents. The SWP was a Trotskyist group which traced its origins back to the anti-World War I left wing of the Socialist Party led by Eugene Victor Debs. It advocated for a democratic form of socialism unlike what existed in the Soviet Union. At its peak, it had 3,000 members, including its youth group. It had a weekly newspaper, a monthly magazine, an international news service, a publishing house, and it owned a five-story headquarters in an old ship repair building in the West Village. It had chapters in most major cities and on many college campuses. It helped organize some of the largest demonstrations against the Vietnam War. The 1986 trial took 3 months. What was proved? The FBI had used 300 infiltrators and 1,300 informers over a 15-year period and burglarized SWP offices and members' homes more than 200 times. Wiretaps had been employed for 20,000 days and listening devices for 12,000. Landlords were contacted in an effort to get people evicted, and workplaces were visited in order to get people fired. The agents were also instructed to stir up mistrust in the movement and create antagonistic factions inside the party, such as by sending anonymous letters to a prominent black SWP member insisting that he and his fellow, quote, party monkeys should leave and join the Black Panthers. Agents tried to get the party to engage in illegal activities, such as by handing out flyers at an anti-war demonstration, calling the SWP and other organizers cowards for not wanting to get, quote, battle wounds, fighting the, quote, pigs. The 1986 victory was historic. The federal court decision held that advocating for socialism and being in a socialist organization were legal, ruling that, quote, these disruption operations were directed at the kind of political activities that the SJP had a constitutional right to carry out. Quote, for the first time, the FBI's disruptions, surreptitious entries, and use of informers have been found unconstitutional, the Nation magazine wrote. Quote, all in all, it amounted to a domestic counter-operation against a peaceful political organization for no reason other than its ideological orientation. The FBI had played its role as the, quote, political police of the national government, Noam Chomsky wrote. The federal government, represented by the then U.S. Attorney Rudolph Giuliani, maintained to the bitter end that it had a right to undermine an organization just because of its ideas. No government official who participated in the campaign against the SWP was ever prosecuted, and no congressional hearings were ever held. In the post-9/11 era, even the modest legal restraints that were imposed on law enforcement surveillance and infiltration of political activity during the 1970s have been tossed aside. The surveillance state has grown even larger with the creation of the Department of Homeland Security that works closely with the FBI and local police departments to monitor lawful political dissent. The FBI has already infiltrated Muslim mosques and admitted to a program of targeting those whom they call, quote, black identity extremists, that is, black people organizing to oppose police violence. Under Obama, the FBI and Homeland Security worked closely with local police departments in the fall of 2011 to monitor and ultimately break up the Occupy encampments in various cities. We need to build solid organizations that can withstand government attempts at disruption. Here are some key practices to remember. We should not advocate anything illegal, keeping in mind that the government will try to put the onus of violence on us rather than on them where it belongs. Don't say anything on social media or other electronic communications you would not want the government to see. They have access to all of it when they want it. Within our social movements, don't turn political disagreements into personal feuds. Don't engage in needlessly disruptive behavior, and be wary of those who do so on a regular basis. The government has a long history of using infiltrators to sow strife within left organizations. Socialism is no longer a dirty word. We are growing in numbers and strength. It would be naive to think that the powers that be are not cognizant of the threats to their power and privilege and are not taking steps to block it.
One thing I'd like to add to this piece is that our organization that we're members of, the National Lawyers Guild, was also spied on over the course of several decades.
Yes.
And our lawyer successfully sued to get the FBI to admit they'd spied on us, which they don't do that often.
No. That's state secret.
But they had wired the telephones in the national office. They had a couple of individuals serving on the national boards and I think also the D.C. chapter. They rummaged through people's garbage. They did all the usual tactics that you alluded to.
Yeah. We, of course, know that they're not sitting down on their hands now.
No.
And we've got to be careful about it. But, you know, what did the poet say, Shelley? We are many. They are few.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.